and passed a surveillance team. A magician and his trick builders designed a dolly for rolling luggage that was loaded with varying sizes of suitcases, a steamer trunk, and an ice chest. The facade of the baggage on the dolly appeared completely realistic. Each piece was designed to fit around the legs, arms, torso, and head of a person so that the agent could sit inside and be wheeled out of the hotel by the porter into a waiting van. The operation proceeded without incident, completely confounding the surveillance. CDs are critical to infiltrating secret equipment into a facility. The Trojan horse is often an item desired by the target or a gift given as a gesture of goodwill that conceals a bug, a beacon, or even an explosive device. A Trojan horse operation against a communist country's ambassador in Europe exploited the diplomat's interest in a piece of sculpture he openly admired at a dinner party. The local CIA station reasoned that the sculpture, an impressive large bronze of an old farmer, might be displayed by the ambassador in his embassy conference room. The size of the piece made it an ideal host for an audio device and the batteries necessary for a long service life. The station obtained the original sculpture, but the techs could not create a hollow cavity inside the bronze and restore the original without leaving signs of alteration. The alternative was to sculpt an identical statue and position the eavesdropping package inside the farmer's head before final casting. By creating a forged sculpture, no visible scars would appear on the outside, and the sealed bronze would limit access to the unit if examined by the embassy's technical team. OTS found an accomplished sculptor from among its artists, and the final casting was declared a masterpiece. Even its weight replicated that of the original. When the audio components were tested, the device accurately reproduced the room sounds using a microphone airway the tech had hidden inside the recesses of the farmer's mouth. An access agent presented the statue to the ambassador during a ceremony on the annual celebration of the communist country's National Day. A listening post, a block away from the embassy, recorded the event as the access agent wheeled the bronze into the embassy and made the presentation. After several minutes of listening to diplomatic social chatter, the listening post's keeper remotely switched the device off until the next morning. All waited anxiously to hear where the ambassador would display the sculpture. When the audio was switched on again, the concealed statue continued performing splendidly. The ambassador had it sitting next to him as he conducted his daily briefing of his senior ministers. The placement could not have been better, right in the ambassador's conference room. Congratulations for the CIA officers were, however, premature. The ambassador then announced that a treasure like this statue deserved to stand in the embassy's most prestigious location. All important visitors would pass this prominent spot at the top of the stairs leading to the ambassador's suite, and thus could pause to admire the sculpture. The announcement was terrible news for the operation. The top of the stairs would not be an area used for secret briefings and meetings. The listening post monitored the device for several weeks, but obtained nothing of intelligence value. The concealment tech and sculptor had done their jobs, perhaps too well. Assessment of the ambassador had not anticipated his need to display and show off the magnificent gift. OTS created masking or camouflage for equipment whose size, location, or function precluded concealment, but which could not be left visible. Roof antennas were masked by tool or storage sheds to prevent another security service from determining the antenna's direction and configuration. A laser communication device pointing out of the window of an agent's dining room might be camouflaged as a large decorative urn. The entrance to a secret tunnel in the basement of a safe house could be masked by a bar and wine racks that slide easily aside for the tunnel access. Each masking system is designed to draw attention to the mask itself without attempting to hide the fact of its existence. Because the mask is something that would be expected in the environment, no particular curiosity is aroused, and no further examination of the mask is invited. OTS techs enjoyed James Bond movies for the beautiful women, daring men, quips, and especially for the clever ingenuity exhibited by Major Quentin Boothroyd, known as Q. they never failed to be amazed at how well Q's devices always worked in the field. The gadget master for Her Majesty's service met with Bond before each operation and issued him devices drawn from a seemingly endless array of well-designed and highly crafted gadgets. Q always anticipated needs and applied technology that pushed the boundaries of design, materials, and craftsmanship. In the character of Q, Tex recognized a surprisingly realistic depiction of a scientist, craftsman, intelligence officer who shared many of their everyday problems. Q dealt with officers who were technophobic, worked with people who neither understood nor trusted technology, spent hours teaching the proper use of devices, and unsuccessfully admonished Bond to remember to return the gadget to stores when finished with it. At OTS, a real-life Q would have felt comfortable at a location known simply as the lab. The OTS lab, an hour's drive, or more depending on traffic, from downtown Washington, would have been the dream of any craftsman. One tech, with a university degree in mechanical engineering, remembered thinking that the array of equipment he saw on his first day on the job was awe-inspiring. In the mid-1970s, the lab employed craftsmen and women specialists for all of the hand skills needed for professional concealments: metal and automotive shop, wood, plastic, and ceramic shop, electronics, leather, fabric, glass, seamstress, bookbinding, welding, toolmaking, photography, drafting, and others. The lab seemed to have virtually every piece of equipment available to work on any material. Compared to a university environment, the lab wanted for neither money nor skilled craftsmen. If the concealment tech needed a new tool or piece of equipment, he could get it or make it. Men and women with 20 or more years of experience seemed eager to pass their knowledge on to the new arrival. Not only did the lab have talented techs, it also had the necessary tools and materials, such as industrial-quality sewing machines for professional work with textiles, fabric, and leather. Thousands of dollars worth of the finest glove and belt weight leathers, dyes of every color, along with cutting and buffing machines, were available to make items appear factory new or old as dirt. The shop could produce handbags with fine stitching and maintained a selection of needles, guards for hands, colors and weights of threads, and various types of fabrics. In the metal shop, there were tools that few universities could afford, including special gauges and single-purpose cutters. The cabinet-making shop turned out furniture, molding, or decorative boxes with the look, craftsmanship, and quality of the finest manufacturer. Exotic woods were available to match any operational need. The plastic and electronic shops were similarly equipped. As clandestine ops in the Soviet Union accelerated, the lab devoted half of its concealment output to supporting these operations. Soviet operations were considered so sensitive that case officers demanded a different type of concealment item for every operation, and since no item was ever repeated, each required the full process from design to fabrication. Items with the largest cavities were usually wooden structures such as bookcases and desks. Techs in the 1970s designed and built all CD furniture from scratch, from unfinished raw wood to completed desk, bookcase, or bedstand. Later, in the 1980s, solid wood products began to be replaced on the commercial market with furniture constructed from particle board, which was less expensive, but frequently heavier and less durable. Since the tech's job was to produce CDs that blended in with other contemporary furniture, the lab shifted its construction to particle board as well. For the OTS craftsman, this change was accompanied by a noticeable fall-off in the quality of furniture and increased operational difficulties. A case officer who issued a particle board CD bookcase learned that, after one or two moves, the tolerances and alignment of latches necessary for the CD to function properly did not hold up nearly as well as those in solid wood. The techs found adjustments almost impossible, so the only solution was to build a new piece. Although wood was most frequently used, by no means was it the only host material employed for concealments. The lab could construct CDs in toolboxes, toasters, power supplies, large step-down transformers, 2,000-watt models that were available overseas, bases of small refrigerators, small air conditioners, and vehicles. The shop was equipped to work in plastics, a material that went through phases of popularity in the consumer marketplace. However, plastic generally was so light that if used as a CD for any weighty item, an explanation was required as to why this apparently lightweight plastic set of drawers seemed so heavy and solid. The OTS concealment shop was the ultimate form, fit, and function business that encouraged imagination. "If you can think it, you can do it," became the unofficial motto. The techs called their lab the greatest toy shop in the world. Concealment techs understood that if there was an intuitive or obvious means of opening the host device, the CD would not meet the level of security required for its clandestine use. Therefore, they pursued a continuing search for a hidden catch or an inventive new way to keep something hidden from anyone other than the intended user. Catches and latches became the stock in trade of concealment specialists, since if the compartment could be opened by anyone, it was not an acceptable CD. Hinges, magnets, pins, slides, pneumatic tubes, and even old-fashioned pull bolts were used to create an array of concealed openings. Generally, to open a CD required twists, turns, or pulls in a precise combination that functioned as a form of mechanical code that had to be performed before gaining access. The techs recognized that concealments in everyday items had to look normal, yet be easily opened by those who knew the code. An OTS concealment tech in the 1970s remembers designing and building a concealment that required normal manual dexterity to open the device. However, word later came back to the tech that the device, though perfect in every other aspect, was not usable because the agent had non-functional arthritic thumbs. The case officer had not previously provided this information about the agent's limitations, and the tech never thought to ask for it. It was a lesson long remembered. Only by observing and asking probing questions during the design process could the tech devise a concealment that made the agent feel as if the device had always been a part of him. The successful concealments matched the CD to the person, and the CD became second nature when used and operated. Every CD was designed to meet an anticipated level of threat. A low-threat CD for the home of a case officer might be adequate for hiding his office attaché case, which itself was a CD. At the other extreme were CDs used to transport sensitive materials across international borders, where they were subjected to X-ray and magnetometer readings, as well as physical examinations. Sometimes, a perfect-looking dead-drop CD was not enough. It also had to pass the smell test. In the late 1970s, the KGB determined that some of the OTS dead-drop concealments made from wood to resemble tree limbs had been assembled using a type of epoxy whose odor was detectable by specially trained KGB dogs. The unfortunate success of the KGB in discovering some containers led the lab to identify the flaw in their production process and replace the epoxy with a non-scented adhesive. The techs were ever conscious that an agent's life often depended on the skill and ingenuity they used to fabricate the CD. If spy gear inside a CD was discovered, it became prima facie evidence of espionage. Such a compromise would not only seal the fate of the agent, but could result in the detection of other agents using similar equipment and lead to the arrest of the handler. The craftsmen of high-threat CDs worked under dual requirements, that the host could always be subjected to physical search, and an item's design had to fit with the agent's lifestyle and cover. When completed, the host would look and function exactly as expected in the agent's environment, and the concealment cavity be inaccessible to anyone unaware of the mechanical cipher. Detailed drawings of the concealment host and thorough documentation of concealment issuances were maintained. These records became invaluable should a CD be lost or compromised. If other CDs like it had been issued in the same country, they might need to be recalled and replaced. Once hostile counterintelligence officers learned of a CD and how it was manipulated and opened, they could be expected to be on the lookout for similar pieces. OTS concealment makers were masters of craft and illusion. Whimsy, smoke, and mirrors were as much the materials of CDs as wood and metal and fabric. It was expected that the techs would be masters of the fabrication skills required of their craft, but they constantly challenged each other to reach the next level by making materials do things they were not intended or expected to do. The best CDs used materials in ways not done elsewhere, and possibly never done before. Fabrication skills were one part of creating an illusion. The thought process for the initial idea was of equal importance and an indispensable step in designing a device. Concealments worked because people assumed what they observed was the only reality. A person looking at a lamp could not imagine that illumination was its secondary feature. The primary function of the lamp was storage, storing the hidden camera that was taking the observer's picture. For clandestine operations, illusion and CDs work together because people want to believe what they see. The OTS techs succeeded brilliantly in fabricating concealments from physical materials. In time, their next challenge would be to do the same with electronic software. Chapter 23. Clandestine Surveillance. He was now black, free of surveillance. Moscow was his. Milt Bearden in The Main Enemy. The word surveillance comes from the French surveiller, to watch over. The CIA broadened the definition to watching from anywhere and relied on TSS and its successor organizations to build and deploy special equipment for surveillance and counter-surveillance operations. The CIA has used surveillance for both offensive and defensive purposes by secretly collecting information about the movement and activity of recruitment targets, and used counter-surveillance to protect CIA officers engaged in clandestine acts. Surveillance operations employ stationary, fixed or static, or mobile assets as needed. Stationary surveillance refers to sustained observations made from fixed sites, which can be apartment buildings, cafes, airports, or intersections. The monitoring attempts to identify either the people transiting the site or the type of activity conducted at the location. The target site would be observed from an observation post manned by trained surveillance personnel using still and video camera systems. As the capability and reliability of visual surveillance equipment improved, unmanned observation posts that recorded and transmitted images to a control point significantly reduced the number of personnel required for multiple fixed surveillance sites. Mobile surveillance, conducted primarily by foot, automobile, or airplane, tracks a person or other moving target, such as a vehicle or shipping container. OTS supplied concealed surveillance cameras, disguises, and specialized communication equipment for mobile teams. Mobile surveillance becomes particularly important when terrorists are identified and their movements need to be observed and plotted. Surveillance photography serves dual operational purposes: to establish positive photo identification of a target, and operational acts such as meetings, exchanges of documents, and payoffs. The quality of the photography depends on selecting the right camera for the operational environment. In a stationary observation post, typically located inside a building, camouflaged cameras are pre-positioned to photograph a target and can be controlled manually or remotely. Inside an apartment or hotel room with a common wall to the target, covert photographs can be taken from behind a ventilation grill, through a pinhole lens, or using a pre-installed camera port. Images from digital cameras may be immediately transmitted to an operational base. In the early 1990s, film cameras began to be replaced by high-resolution digital cameras. At first, images were recorded to videotape and then later to digital storage media. The advantages of advanced storage capacity and digital transmission of captured images expanded the applications for photographic surveillance. Miniaturization and capacity advances in the 1990s of small, low-light video cameras allowed video concealments to employ many of the same techniques previously used by audio surveillance to hide small microphones in woodblocks, books, or office equipment. Mobile observation posts, using surveillance cameras carried by a person on foot or riding on a bicycle, car, train, or aircraft, add another capability for covert collection. Concealment requirements and the need to compensate for the target's movement limit the choice of cameras for mobile posts when compared to the fixed sites. At close range to the target, traditional camera systems will often be concealed beneath the user's clothing or inside a briefcase or purse. The ubiquitous presence of cell phones and their integrated imaging features fundamentally altered the nature of visual surveillance by creating the reality that any action done in public is likely to have been photographed by someone. Historically, for intelligence photography, 35mm cameras with varying lengths of standard and telephoto lenses provided the highest possible level of detail, resolution, in still images. In 2001, with the advent of the Nikon D1X, 5.9 million effective pixels, OTS accelerated its movement toward digital imaging for all photographic requirements. At greater distances, cameras with long lenses make a target appear closer and enlarge the image on the film media. These telephoto lenses could be 500 millimeters, 1,000 millimeters, 2,000 millimeters, or even longer. A lens 300 millimeters or longer is almost impossible to hand-hold without a tripod or other means of support. The commercially available Questar 7 2,800mm lens with a 35mm camera and tripod can read the numbers on a license plate from more than 2 miles away with adequate lighting and favorable atmospheric conditions. Because surveillance pictures using film cameras are often taken at night during periods of little light, careful selection of available light, ultra-high-speed film, or infrared materials are required. Available light photography requires the fastest available film and steady support. The sensitivity of commercially available ultra-high-speed film to ASA 6400 can be push-processed to sensitivity above ASA 50,000 by manipulating the developing time, development temperature, or both. At these extreme ASA levels, it is possible to photograph a subject at night illuminated by a single birthday candle. Infrared surveillance photography that takes place at the end of the light spectrum is not visible to the unaided eye and requires only a standard 35mm camera, infrared film, and a strobe flash unit with an infrared filter. Tracking devices, particularly beacons, aid mobile surveillance when close surveillance is impractical or undesirable. Tracking devices are selected based on the nature of the target and operational issues. In practice, beacons are most useful in tracking inanimate objects, such as vehicles and shipping containers. Success in implanting a covert beacon inside the human body, despite assertions by some that my teeth contain government-installed devices, eluded the CIA. Contrary to certain remarkable scenes in spy movies, OTS found that human behavior, combined with technical limitations imposed by laws of physics, made personal beaconing practically impossible. Beacons are considered both strategic and tactical. Tactical beacons, monitored from ground receivers, are usually located within a short range of the target. Strategic beacons may be monitored from a high-flying aircraft or satellites. Most clandestine beacons use a small radio frequency transmitter to broadcast a navigational signal to the surveillance team. For example, the CIA might covertly insert satellite-tracked beacons inside shipping containers of shoulder-fired missiles being transported by terrorists from Afghanistan to other locations in the Middle East, and place a tactical beacon on a pickup that is hauling a few of the missiles to a terrorist safe house. During the Vietnam War, TSD disguised a small beacon inside imitation animal dung. Left in the foliage adjacent to a North Vietnamese Army or Viet Cong campsite, the active beacon would not be noticed or disturbed because of its appearance. Attack aircraft could home in on the signal that pinpointed the site for destruction. In the Middle East, beacons were deployed inside briefcases and belts to protect individuals at high risk against kidnapping. When activated by non-alerting movements of the wearer, the beacon transmitted a signal for help and provided the location of the kidnapped individual. Software beacons were created for operations against cell phones and portable computers. With brief access to a target's laptop or cell phone, the beaconing software could be installed, and thereafter, anytime the target used his cell phone or logged onto the internet with his laptop, his position was logged and his emails and conversations intercepted. Taggants represent another means for tracking movements by identifying a targeted individual as he passes through choke points within the operational area. Similar to the plastic security tags attached to clothing that must be removed before departing a store, taggants made of chemicals, pheromones, or electronics can be remotely detected and the tagged individual identified. One of the best-known taggants used by the KGB was spy dust, the chemical compound 5-4-nitrophenyl-2-4-pentadiene-1-AL, NPPD. The Soviets' use of spy dust was of such concern to CIA operatives that OTS established a special program to analyze and counter the material. The CIA employed audio, visual, physical, forensic, and electronic technical aids to enhance the organized study and observation of targets. Throughout most of the Cold War, audio operations and satellite photography dominated technical collection successes. Audio operations were an original function of the technical services staff, but initially were no more important than printing, concealments, and disguise. However, by 1960, audio technical surveillance had become TSS's top priority. Audio operations, designed to obtain positive or operational intelligence, targeted communication systems or facilities where conversations of interest might occur. Government telephone lines, official foreign missions and facilities, an office, residence, or hotel room, all were exploited by the audio techs. Traditional landline telephones were particularly vulnerable to clandestine tapping. Almost every target individual anywhere in the world had and used a phone. The handset contained a high-quality microphone built into the mouthpiece and was connected to wires leading out of the building. TSS developed three basic systems for bugging phones in the early 1950s that remained viable for decades. By tapping the line, both parties talking could be heard and the full conversation captured. The tap might require direct contact with the wires, or an inductive tap could be fitted as a collar around a line without making physical contact with the internal wires. An alternative was to modify the phone. Normally, when a telephone receiver is placed on its cradle, the depressed hook switch ends the call. TSS developed a technique in the 1950s to bypass remotely the hook switch in order to use the sensitive mouthpiece microphone to listen in on all room sounds and conversation. Usually, a tech required access to the telephone to make the modification, but if the make and model of the targeted telephone could be obtained, a hook switch bypass modification to an identical instrument could be made. Then, similar to a quick plant operation, a cleaning person or service personnel could covertly exchange phones. The third basic system exploited the telephone's own current. Telephone instruments draw current from the telephone company for power to operate the unit and activate the bell or ringer. This power level was sufficient to support other bugs and listening devices in the room and eliminated the need for batteries to be replaced. Cellular telephones are particularly vulnerable to audio attacks. Cellular conversations can be intercepted while transmitting between the nearest cell tower and the handset, or as the signal is relayed between towers to the telephone exchange. All data and conversations sent to and from a cell phone, including emails, videos, images, and text messages, can be captured without any physical access to the phone itself. Cell phones can be located to within 100 feet by triangulating the signal strength of the cell phone with the three nearest cell towers. By integrating this geographical positioning data with a moving map display, movements of the cell phone can be monitored in near real time. A cell phone can also be bugged by gaining access to the instrument for the time required to swap batteries. Modified batteries containing a microphone, digital storage media, and computer chip constitute a self-contained eavesdropping system.